We present the unbelievable truth, the panel game built on truth and lies. In the chair, please welcome David Mitchell.
Welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. Please welcome Angela Barnes, Mark Steele, Ria Lina and Alan Davis. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Angela Barnes. Angela, your subject is spies, people employed by a state or institution to obtain secret information from rival countries, organisations or companies. Off you go, Angela. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
I myself am a spy. Oh no, hang on. This programme goes out to 700 million people. I've blown my cover already. This is almost as bad as the time my friend Jeff the Spy blew his cover on the Today programme by accidentally giving his real name. Or when my other friend, a guy called John the Spy, had his false moustache fall off on The One Show. The game I Spy was invented as a secret agent assessment tool during the Cold War. Parents would collate the results of their children's I Spy games and submit them to MI5, who could then analyse the suitability of their offspring for the service.
Rhea.
There was a time where there were puzzles that were given to kids in kids' magazines. So is that the MI5 I Spy thing reference?
I'm not sure the game I Spy was that tricky.
No, yes. but it did happen, just differently.
I think
to
it
the way that you
yes.
said it.
So the differently is the key there. What's different about what happened is what happened was true and that was a lie, unfortunately.
If it's half true, as I pointed out, could I only lose half a point?
I would say we've got to say that truth is...
absolute.
It's binary.
Is it?
You know, yeah. We have to say a thing is true or not true.
Tell that to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spies, variously known as wingtips, logjammers, cardigans or spoons, didn't exist in Britain until the early 1970s.
Mark.
Spoons. I think they're sometimes known as spoons.
They're not. No. Spooks.
No, I know spooks, but... Yeah.
It's only a letter out. By Rhea's system, you should have sort of 80% of a point.
Spies didn't exist in Britain until the early 1970s, following the invention of the night vision goggle, which was in 1966, and the decriminalisation of eavesdropping, which was in 1967.
Alan.
Because I haven't said anything yet, I thought I'd better chip in. I wonder if night vision was invented in 1966.
No.
Oh.
No, it wasn't.
Have you said anything true yet?
I might.
Do you think that thing about the 700 million, do you think that was true?
No, I think Jeff actually did give away his real name on a show.
Is this just sort of off-the-ball speculation? Yeah.
This is like the pundits after a half-time. Gary Neville. They've missed a couple of obvious truths there. And you can't give Angela that much space.
Angela.
In the spirit of British fair play and to create a level playing field for agents of foreign powers, GCHQ publishes an annual handbook outlining any developments in their surveillance and security techniques, which is widely available online.
Mark.
Yeah, they do that, GCHQ.
Of course they don't!
As Angela has implied.
How institutions work anymore. So that's quite reasonable. We've got trains that don't go anywhere, so why can't we have
a
spy system?
They don't make them available online, but they do sometimes leave them in a briefcase on the train.
No, unfortunately, that's not true, Mark. Angela, carry on.
However, to maintain an air of mystery, code names used for said surveillance techniques include the following: Grubby Tattooist, Athlete's Foot, Clumsy Beekeeper, Camp Coffee, and German Measles. The writer Ian Fleming based
his... Should we do one each? Just take one each. It's just
genuinely. Rhea.
I'm going to have to opt for Rubella, German Measles.
German Measles is not true.
One of the other ones.
Possibly.
I can't remember them now.
I'll
Athlete's
take...
Foot.
Not true.
Oh, Rhea.
Sorry, I can remember it.
Alan, you buzzed again?
Yeah, one of the other ones.
The other ones are... Clumsy beekeeper.
Yeah.
You're going with clumsy beekeeper. Correct. The panel has broken through at massive cost.
Honestly, it's harder than the Enigma machine.
Yeah. That's why I'm a spy.
Clumsy beekeeper was the code name of a GCHQ computer surveillance technique used by British spies.
The writer Ian Fleming based his famous spy character James Bond on MI5's legendary spook Arthur Bond, the most decorated British spy of World War II. In fact, you could say Arthur was the premium Bond. Thank you.
Oh.
People considered for the part of Bond over the years are Duncan from Blue, Arthur Scargill, one of Anton Deck, the bloke who played Nasty Nick on EastEnders, and Lord Lucan. The reason Fleming chose did you buzz?
Who is the second guy?
No one buzzed. No, there's just a general sense of bafflement.
Right, okay, fine.
Who is the second one?
Was it some man called Scargill?
Arthur Scargill.
Withdraw that.
Oh, okay, I withdraw. I don't know that.
You're not going for Arthur Scargill.
I am not.
Argy Munded, it was shaken and not stirred.
The reason Fleming chose 007 as Bond's code name was because it's also the Moscow postal code for the KGB headquarters, the international dialing code for Russia, and the number of Fleming's favourite dish from his local Chinese takeaway.
Thank you, Angela.
Oh. One of them.
And Angela, at the end of that round, you've used subterfuge brilliantly and smuggled four truths past the rest of the
way.
Only clumsy beekeeper was discovered, and at enormous cost. So,
wow.
Yes, the first truth was that a guy called John the Spy had his false moustache fall off on the One Show. In 2006, journalist Justin Rowlett was interviewing the first operational intelligence officer to appear in front of a TV camera for the One Show when his false moustache began to peel off halfway through filming. Rowlett told The Telegraph, when we had a break in the filming, I said to him, John, the old moustache is coming off. He said, oh, God, I thought that might happen.
And yet you laughed at the idea that they publish all their findings online.
The second truth is that eavesdropping was decriminalised in 1967.
Really?
It was a criminal offence to eavesdrop in England and Wales until that year. And the third truth is that Lord Lucan was considered for the part of Bond.
Shut the front door.
Lord Lucan was considered by Bond producer Cubby Broccoli for the role of James Bond. John Bingham, 7th Earl of Lucan, was regarded by Broccoli as, quote, the very image of Commander Bond.
You know he was cast as the Invisible Man in the end.
Yes! Yes! Some of you not applauding, come on! And the fourth truth is that 007 is the international dialing code for Russia. And that means, Angela, you've scored 4 points. In 2008, two pigeons at an Iranian nuclear facility were arrested for spying. Authorities were worried about a coup. Okay, we turn now to Mark Steele. Mark, your subject is bread, a food typically made from flour, water and yeast, which are mixed together and baked. Fingers on buzzers, everyone else. Off you go, Mark.
The role of bread in Christianity became controversial in the 3rd century when it was revealed that the line in the Lord's Prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread," had been included because of pressure from the Vatican bakery, which was run by St. Hovis. Since then, Jesus has regularly tried to prove his powers by appearing in slices of toast. However, it was also reported that England midfielder Frank Lampard appeared in a naan bread just after he was sacked for the 3rd time as Chelsea manager.
Angela.
That's the sort of thing you see in the Daily Star, isn't it? I think Frank Lampard appeared in a naan bread.
No, he didn't. And in fact, he's only been Chelsea manager twice.
Oh.
So it may yet happen.
Ex-Chancellor George Osborne appeared in a tuna sandwich in a Greggs in Derby. And on eBay, a man from Berkshire sold a piece of toast with the face of Joe Pasquale.
Rhea.
I mean, people buy round eggs, so I'm going to go with the
round eggs?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was one recently, wasn't there? It was in the paper the other day.
There was another one recently. People bought it for extreme sums of money.
You wouldn't want to pass that, would you?
Well, I think it's...
I wouldn't want to pass any sort of egg, to be honest.
Can I just say, as the only person on the panel who's passed a human through that part of her body, that I would much rather pass an egg. If I had a choice between, like, knobbly elbows and a head that's way too big.
Yeah, but what if the human was perfectly spherical?
How did we get onto round eggs?
I blame Rhea.
No, I was just saying that if someone will buy a round egg on eBay, they probably bought a piece of toast with Joe Pasquale's face on it.
Well, you're absolutely right. Yes, in 2004, Guy Harris from Thatcham, Berkshire, said he noticed Joe Pasquale's face staring out at him from a slice of toast while he was preparing his breakfast. He said, "I couldn't believe it, so I grabbed my camera and took a photo. It's like that Virgin Mary slice that someone had on eBay recently, but better."
Bradley Walsh demands a crusty white bread roll before each recording of The Chase, and...
Angela.
Yeah, I reckon he does. I think Bradley Walsh is a crusty cob sort of bloke.
As far as we know, he doesn't demand that, so...
And Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses insists white bread is on his rider, having revealed the song Paradise City is about an imaginary land in which buildings and cars are made out of baguettes. When Bread for All was adopted as the slogan of the Bolsheviks in revolutionary Russia, this was partly to inspire the masses, but also because Lenin and Trotsky had signed an advertising deal with Warburton's.
Angela.
Was it Bread for All? Was that a slogan of the Russian Revolution?
No, it was bread, peace and land.
Oh, OK.
Just bread's easier, isn't it? Peace and land.
That's the trouble. Yeah.
That's the trouble. They went too far with their demands, you see. Mean,
frankly, if you can get the peace and land, don't worry about the bread.
Bread has played a central role in the history of communism. For example, pita bread was banned by Mao Zedong for being middle class. And toasters were banned in Cuba. This followed an attempt by the CIA to assassinate Fidel Castro by sending an electrician to rewire his toaster in a way that would set fire to his beard.
Angela.
I know the CIA did some really mad things, so I reckon that's one of them. They rewired his toaster.
They didn't. Oh. No. Rhea.
Did they ban toasters in Cuba because they don't have electricity?
They did. That's the truth. Well done. Other electrical items such as irons, air conditioners and microwave ovens were also banned.
In Norfolk, swans turned blue after eating bread, and this made them camouflaged against the blue sky, and they kept getting hit by planes until they evolved a way of honking in a Norfolk accent. Sainsbury's briefly made a range of animal breads, a giraffe bread, a panther bread, a puppy bread.
Angela.
I think they did make a range of animal breads. I know tiger bread's a thing. Did they do other animals as well in Sainsbury's?
Well, what animal would you say they might have done?
Giraffe.
Correct.
Yes!
Way!
Yes, in 2012, Sainsbury's began selling what they called giraffe bread after receiving a letter from a three-year-old girl saying their tiger bread looked more like a giraffe. A Chris King from Sainsbury's customer services replied, saying, "It's called tiger bread because the first baker who made it a long time ago thought it looked stripy like a tiger. Maybe they were a bit silly." He included a £3 gift card. All right, don't break the bank. The correspondence went viral on Twitter. That was before it was toxic. And as a result, Sainsbury's were persuaded to change the name of tiger bread to giraffe bread.
So that's proof that democracy works. And when sliced bread was invented in 1949, it was advertised as the best thing since unsliced bread.
Angela.
Was sliced bread invented in 1949? You could buy it sliced for the first time in 1949, maybe.
No, sliced bread, as in fully sliced, pre-sliced,
was
invented in 1928.
Ah.
So it was old news by 1949. And it was advertised not as the best thing since unsliced bread, but the greatest step forward in the baking industry since bread was wrapped. So it's i.e. the best thing since bagged bread. And that's the end of Mark's lecture. And at the end of that round, Mark, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses insists white bread is on his rider. And then a long list for the band, including Jack Daniels, vodka, a lot of beer, a lot of cigarettes, and an assortment of adult magazines. The second truth is that in Norfolk, swans turned blue after eating bread. Oh. This was related to a nutritional deficiency, as the swans were living entirely on bread thrown to them by passers-by and not eating a balanced diet. Stupid swans. And that means, Mark, you've scored 2 points. Next up is Ria Lina. Ria's mother is from the Philippines and her father is from Germany. Though growing up, she attended an American school based in the Netherlands before attending university in Scotland and settling in England. On hearing that, Nigel Farage exploded. Ria, your subject is numbers. Arithmetic values that are used to represent quantity and used in counting or making calculations. Off you go, Ria.
Karen's number is the world's most negative number. It would make you weep just writing it. Graham's number is so big it doesn't fit into the observable universe, but to everyone else, it's 5.5 inches.
Angela.
Graham's number. Is, yes. Graham's number the real one?
Graham's number is the real one. Right. Correct. And... what Graham's number is a tremendously large finite number that is named after the mathematician Ronald Graham. It was listed as the world's largest number in the 1980 Guinness Book
of Records. I can beat that. Graham's number plus one.
Why can't you just do that, Ria?
Yeah, Ria, yeah, why?
Just, why can't you just add one to Graham's number and then it's David's number is Graham's number plus one?
I think, if I'm honest, my assumption is that it's irrational.
Come here with your science.
You're intimidating us with learning.
The UK is the only country that uses the emergency number 999. In Bangkok, it's 69. In China, they dial 888. While in Germany, if you want an ambulance, you dial 483-759-2384-7432-9615. And if you can manage that, then chances are you don't need an ambulance.
Alan.
Eight's a lucky number, isn't it, in China? So would that be true? Or is it just a very clever joke?
It's a very clever joke, yes, I'm afraid, yes. In China, you need to dial 119 for firefighters, 110 for police, and 120 for an ambulance.
People who are good at maths are twice as likely to be sexually active in old age, which is why men think they are much better at maths than they really are.
Mark.
Yeah, I reckon that's true. You're twice as likely to be sexually active in old age if you're good at maths.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I've never been so happy that my husband's got a maths degree.
A 2016 survey of thousands of British over 50s found that pensioners who can do basic calculations are twice as likely to be sexually active than those who cannot. Even among those in their 80s, one in five who got maths questions right had had sex in the past 12 months, compared to one in 10 for those who got them wrong.
Or is it that maths nerds, even when they're old, go, yeah, I did have some sex last week, but she went to another school?
On Earth, the dead outnumber the living by 20 to 1. Although, if we were counting in the Irish language, I'd have to be careful because they use different numbers for counting humans from counting non-humans, or as they're known in Ireland, the English.
Angela.
Do they use different numbers for counting non-humans than humans? Is there a different...
Yes, yeah. There is. Yes. In the Irish language, the words for numbers change depending on whether you're counting humans or non-humans. And in addition, there's a third set of numbers in Irish for doing arithmetic or referring to dates and times. Mm.
The temperature outdoors can be estimated to within several degrees by counting the number of chirps of a cricket in a 15-second period and adding 40 to the total.
Angela.
Something about crickets and temperature.
You're absolutely right, yes. Yeah. It's called Dolbear's Law after Amos Dolbear, who discovered the phenomenon in 1897. His observations showed that you can count the number of cricket chirps during a period of 15 seconds, add 40, and that will give you the temperature in Fahrenheit.
How did he find that out? Was he just going round and round the woods going, right, let's see what happens if we set fire to all the grasshoppers? No, you can't tell from that. Let's see if you count the number of cricket chirps.
Well, you've got to remember, Mark, that he didn't have a phone.
And also, Mark, you can take the piss out of him, but he's going to be having sex when he's 90.
Well, this was in 1897, so he probably died when he was 53, didn't he?
of sex.
Thank you, Rhea. And at the end of that round, Rhea, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that men think that they are much better at maths than they really are. According to a 2015 US study where participants undertook maths tests and had them predict how many problems they had solved correctly, men tended to overestimate their scores, whereas women offered much more accurate assessments of their mathematical abilities. The researchers suggest women may benefit from adopting a similar positive illusion.
Or men could just tell the truth.
Yeah, but the thing is, they think they are telling the truth. That's what's so adorable about men. And that means, Rhea, you've scored 1 point. It's now the turn of Alan Davis. Your subject, Alan, is names, words by which people or things are known, addressed, or referred to. Off you go, Alan.
The name Donald has origins in Gaelic and means ruler of the world. So what about the name Trump?
Rhea.
Does Donald actually mean ruler of the world?
It does.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Destiny. Karl Marx and his wife Jenny named all four of their daughters Jenny, and in order to tell them apart, they referred to them as Jenny Marx with the curly hair who never speaks and plays the harp, Jenny the pianist with the Italian accent, Jenny with the black moustache and cigar, and the other Jenny. It's thought that Jack the Ripper had an unhappy childhood, mainly because he'd been christened Jack the Ripper.
Rhea.
I'm willing to bet Jack the Ripper had an unhappy childhood. Yeah.
Well, we don't know his identity, and so we can't know whether he had an unhappy
but
childhood.
But then you don't know that it isn't true, do you?
No, but I don't know that it's true, do I? So it's...
Are you back to your absolutism when it comes to truth?
Yep.
The Goldbergs had a daughter who was unfortunately prone to childhood flatulence. So rather than change their surname to Trump, they gave the girl a nickname, which has stayed with her throughout her glittering career. Whoopi Goldberg. The name Lancelot means prone to boils.
Rhea.
I love Whoopi, but I also love that story. Is that a nickname from childhood for her?
It is indeed. Yeah. Yes, Whoopi Goldberg was prone to flatulence in her youth and was named Whoopi as a result, though not by her parents. According to Whoopi herself, quote, "No one christened me Whoopi, I'm Karen, but I was a bit of a farter. The theatres I was performing in were very small, so if you were gassy, you had to walk away farting, and people would say I was like a Whoopi cushion." The nickname stuck.
Everyone who's been sea swimming will know of the breadcrumb sponge. The scientist who first discovered it called it Panis spongii. Then some other scientists believed they had discovered it and gave it another name. Since then, the breadcrumb sponge has been discovered so many times, it now has 56 different Latin names.
Angela.
Is the... Oh, God, which bit of that's true? That it has lots of Latin names.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, researchers compiling a new world register of marine species discovered that one Atlantic sponge, the breadcrumb sponge, which gets its name from its crumbly texture when picked up, had been given 56 Latin names by scientists who thought each of its many manifestations constituted a different species.
I had a cocktail named after me at university. I say a cocktail, I dropped a pork pie into a hooch.
I'll ask for an Angela Barnes the next time I go to the Savoy. Yes. I'm sorry, we're fresh out of pork pie. Alan.
When Elvis Presley's daughter, Lisa Marie, was born, he wanted to call her Wilhelmina. That would have meant he That would have meant he could go, Wilhelmina, bless my soul. I'll wait for the buzz there, I'll wait for the buzz. At a launching ceremony, Liz Truss named a cruise liner, "Oh bugger, it's all over my frock," when the when the bottle of champagne slipped out of her hand. In the 19th century, they had nicknames for absolutely everything, especially the many and varied sexual positions enjoyed by the Victorians. These included... the vicar's special, the ordinary with legs up, the lewd trumpeter, the shy trampolinist, and brace yourself, Sheila.
Okay, Angela, you buzzed first.
I'm going to say ordinary with legs up.
You're absolutely right. Yes. The ordinary with legs up is a sexual position listed in the book Instruction Libertine, A Girl's Guide to the Knowledge of Good and Evil, which is a 19th century sex manual for young, inexperienced ladies that, amongst other things, provides descriptive instructions to 63 sexual positions.
There are 63!
It was published in Paris in 1860 by Frederick Hankey. Presumably of Panky fame, who'd settled in the city in 1847 and built up there an extensive library of erotic literature. Other sex positions listed by Hankey are the spiky chair, the view of the Low Countries, waste not, want not, and the grand entrance. So, yeah, well spotted, Angela. And that's the end of Alan's lecture. And at the end of that round, Alan, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that Karl and Jenny Marx's four daughters were all named Jenny after their mother. They were Jenny Caroline, Jenny Laura, Jenny Evelyn and Jenny Julia. And that means, Alan, you've scored 1 point. Which brings us to the final scores. In second equal place, with minus 1 point each, we have Ria Lina, Alan Davis, and Mark Steele. And in first place, with an unassailable 4 points, it's this week's winner, Angela Barnes. And that's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Angela Barnes, Mark Steele, Ria Lina and Alan Davis. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.